Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her book, The Circus in Winter. Kathy Day was born in Peru, Indiana, the winter home of the Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus at the turn of the century. She received her MFA from the University of Alabama and currently teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you for having me.
How about we start out tonight with you reading from The Circus in Winter?
Okay. I'm going to be reading a little bit. It's actually from the last story in the book. It's called Circus People. When I was a little girl, my mother told me stories about the old days when the circus people lived in Lima. She told me that when the old-time circuses traveled in brightly painted rail cars across the country, they stopped each night in little places like Middletown, Ohio, Radford, Virginia, Ottumwa, Iowa, Leadville, Colorado. From the railroad siding, the men in the wicky wagon would hang kerosene lamps in the trees to lead the rest of the show to the designated lot on the edge of town. For a night or two, the circus people glittered on dangling silver webs and smiled, sitting atop their roaring beasts. When the shows were over, they dropped canvas and, deep in the night, paraded silently back to the waiting train. And always, there was this danger, that in the morning, the towns of Middletown, Radford, Ottumwa, and Leadville would awaken to empty beds. Their wayward sons and daughters disappeared. My mother told me that small towns tolerate the wanderer because wanderers bring them as much of the outside world as they can bear. A night swarming with circus people satisfies this need for upwards of a year. But small towns don't likewise tolerate the wanderers among them, those who leave on midnight trains, moonlit back roads, or in brightly painted rail cars. Like a parent, the town takes this leaving as a sign of failure it can hardly face. And so, small towns tell their children the same story, intoning it over and over again to keep them from leaving. You are lucky to be from a place where nothing bad happens. Don't believe it, my mother always said. I want you to leave this place someday. Promise me you will. Of course, I told her yes.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her book, The Circus in Winter. So we know there's this intersection of you being born in a place where a circus used to winter, mm-hmm. and then now you have a book that's The Circus in Winter. And I just wanted to, you know, kind of as a warmer up, or just talk about how this project started for you, the stories.
Like you said in the introduction, I was born in Peru, Indiana, which was the winter quarters for the Hagenbeck-Wallace Circus. My great-great-uncle was an elephant trainer. I had another great-great-uncle who was he claimed to be the world's fastest ticket seller. He didn't make change. That was his way of going very quick, going very quickly. Growing up in this town, a town that still celebrates its circus heritage and still has citizens who were former circus people, I didn't really realize how special Peru was actually until I left. I went to college, a little school in Indiana called DePauw University, and I had to write. I was a creative writing major, and I always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know what to write about. And one of my professors said, well, you know, you're from that weird circus town that you talk about sometimes. You talk about elephants and clowns and all this stuff. He says, why don't you write about that? And I was like, oh, God, I don't want to write about that town. I hate that town. I don't want to ever go back there again. And he said, no, I really think you need to write about this. And so as a senior in college, I went back to Peru and did like a research project and looked through the town archives and talked to people. And I realized, you know, there's actually a lot of great stories in this town. So it started actually when I was a college student. I was 22 years old. And then at the University of Alabama, kept working on the stories as an MFA. And then after the MFA, kept working more. And somewhere along the way, decided to not call it Peru. A lot of the stories, when they were first published, it says Peru, Indiana. But eventually decided I needed to call it something else so that it wasn't Peru, so that I could invent. And that's why I renamed it Lima. In the Midwest, it's not Lima, Peru. In the Midwest, if we're going to, you know this.
I do.
If you're going to name a city for a foreign place, you're going to have to mispronounce it. So that's why it's Lima like the bean and not Lima like in Peru.
Yes, that's why it's Cairo, Illinois,
that's
and not
right.
Cairo.
That's right.
Yeah. I always wondered, though, like when they first named it, those towns, were they looking at a map and then they just decided we got to say it different?
I think that the people who settled the Midwest, you know, a lot of the towns around here are named for the people who founded them. Like, you know, Pittsburgh, Gettysburg, you know, the Getty family, you know, they call it, you know, a variation of that. But in the Midwest, people moved farther inland, I think, that they wanted to sort of not do that anymore. And actually, as the story goes, the guy who founded Peru, when he had to come up with a name, he said, "I don't care what it is, as long as it's short." And so that's why it's Peru.
Well, there you go.
There you
if go. You ever find yourself having to name a town, just keep that in mind.
There
Make
you
it
go.
Short. About the research, you know, you mm-hmm. said you did some in the archives, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, is that like a historical society where they have all of that, or a library, or all of the above? Or?
Mm-hmm. In Peru and in Baraboo, Wisconsin, which was the home of the Ringling Brothers, they have wonderful circus museums and circus archives, and those were the two main places where I did most of the research for the book. The Miami County Historical Society maintains a lot of records, and a lot of people who do circus research end up in my town to you know look at. So there's so much there, photographs and old props from the circus days. Tom Mix actually was worked with the circus for a while, and one of his old stage coaches from his circus show is on display in my hometown. So there's a lot of stuff in these places you wouldn't really expect, you know, Baraboo, Wisconsin, or Peru, Indiana, but that's where a lot of that stuff is held.
Yeah, I was wondering what that was like. I was guessing it was a little bit different than just, you know, the nice bound books with the stuff that there was. You know, you would imagine a circus archives to be a little livelier than that, have that kind of stuff, but other stuff too.
Oh yeah, we've got some pretty I'm trying to think of some of the most interesting things I found along the way, like
well, you said there when you said the stagecoach, is it the actual stagecoach? Like you just walk into a room and there it is.
Yeah, it's right there.
Son of a gun.
The other thing that they have in my town that's actually featured in the book is the skull of the elephant that killed my great-great-uncle, the elephant trainer, actually is on display in the town museum along with its tusks. And that was actually the story that I told in college was the skull of the elephant that killed my great-great-uncle sits in the town museum, and nobody believed me. So one of my goals in going back to my hometown that first time was to get my picture taken next to it.
Right.
And I did. So, and it's actually, there's a picture of it in the book, too.
That's great. Mm-hmm. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her book, The Circus in Winter. Kathy, would you read some more?
Sure. One of the stories that a lot of people really seem to like, and it's actually sort of based on a true story, is there was a flood in my town in 1913, and it really devastated the Winter Quarters property, which sat right along the Mississinewa River outside of town. And in that first research trip, I found photographs. I'd heard about the flood, but I'd never actually seen photographs of the devastation afterwards. And I read some oral accounts that they had in their archives. And this little snippet here is based on one of those things that I found. It's the character who's speaking. Her name is Grace, and she is trying to make it through the flood of 1913. I slept in fits and starts, and when I opened my eyes at sunup, I saw what looked like a snake climbing over the windowsill. I screamed and woke Charles, who walked to the window with a shoe, but then he laughed and told me to come see. A big bull elephant from the Winter Quarters had stuck his trunk in the window, and when he leaned against the house, his shivers sent vibrations running through our feet. The water covered his legs and was starting to come up his body, and his eyes, brown like a horse's and fringed with long lashes, kept looking at us like we were at fault. Until then, I realized his life had been one of show and strain in return for human kindness and some hay. I couldn't stand to see him looking at me, pleading. I sat back down on the bed and took up my daughter Mildred in my arms. "Charles," I said, "give him some bread, some food, do something." "What do you want me to do, Grace? We need all our food." "Well, make him go away then," I said. So Charles threw my hairbrush hard against its back, but the brush just glanced off and floated away. He sighed. "I can't make him leave. Maybe he'll go away by himself." But he didn't. The baby wailed in my ear, and the elephant bellowed all day long and shivered the house, and I couldn't look out the window at his eyes, all afraid of cold and death. The elephant's trunk poked around the windowsill like a tongue licking the corners of a mouth. Towards noon, Charles remembered a straw-tick mattress in another room, slid it open, and fed the straw to the elephant out the window. But there wasn't much, and the elephant just wailed louder when the straw was gone. By 5, Bitter cold water almost covered his back. Both the elephant and the baby stopped crying, and then there was only the silence of waiting and the steady thump of current against the house. Charles stood at the window. He's just standing there with his head down. He knows it won't be long. And about the time the sun went down, the trunk slipped off the windowsill, and I got up too and watched the elephant sink down into the brown water. There wasn't a splash, just a swallowing up and a big spray of his last breath of air.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her book, The Circus in Winter. I'm glad you read that section. I found it a stunning story in the book, but man, it just breaks your heart.
The genesis of the story is kind of interesting. My great-grandmother and grandfather did survive the flood, trapped on the second floor of their house with a newborn baby. And my grandmother used to tell me stories about how there's some details in this story about how a log comes in the front door and starts beating on the piano, and the racket just drives them nuts, and the baby won't stop crying. And they eventually, to get the baby to stop crying, kept wetting a handkerchief with brandy to get her drunk enough to finally fall asleep. And I remember that story growing up. And then when I saw the photographs of the circus quarters, I decided to kind of combine the family story and the archival story. I moved the family. My great-grandparents actually lived in town and weren't anywhere near the winter quarters. So I just kind of moved the family out towards near the winter quarters so they could sort of bear witness to all of that. So the elephant could actually be standing outside.
Right.
The photograph that accompanies this story is a real photograph of one of the elephants that stood outside the house of a handler. And this was the thing that was very interesting to me, was that they wanted the elephants to be able to get away. So the handlers dove underneath the water to take off the chains around their feet so that they could run off and find higher ground. But instead, they went straight to the homes of their handlers and just stood there, because their handlers had always taken care of their every need. They'd lost that natural instinct of survival. So that's what was really tragic, is that these people who love these animals so much had to just stand there and watch them die and drown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think that opens up, all of your stories do this, in the best sense of this, they remind me of Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, from the idea of, you know, what I would say is different is in Winesburg, Ohio, I think there's a number of characters who, you know, the term that's always used, which is used in the book, the grotesques.
Mm-hmm.
But they're regular people who are trying to hide their grotesqueness.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost like flipping those people inside out.
Mm-hmm.
With the circus people, the grotesqueness is their business.
Right.
That's what they do.
Right.
But what the stories deal with over and over again in a really compelling way is their humanity,
mm-hmm.
That what was seen on the outside was just business.
I think that's the thing that people who read this book are kind of surprised about, is that I think most people, if you said, okay, write about the circus, they would write about the freaks, the grotesques. But for me, growing up in a place where I knew people, I knew that they used to be clowns or they used to be acrobats, but I just knew them as business owners. I knew them as normal people. So to me, that they weren't freaks. They weren't strange and grotesque. So I guess that's the way that my book is maybe a little bit different than, like, Catherine Dunn's Geek Love.
Mm-hmm.
Is that in my world, the circus, it was people's job. You know, it's what they did. And I was more interested in what their lives were like during the wintertime, when they were just, you know, normal people not performing and not putting on a show.
Well, and it's almost the perspective of, you know, in a way, though we're looking inward at the characters, the sensibility, I guess I would say, is I kept thinking of them looking out at the audience instead. Like, mm-hmm. we know how you're looking at us,
mm-hmm.
but here's what our lives are really like.
Right. And that's what I'm, you know, that's what I think any writer should be the most interested in, is not what's on the surface, but, you know, that's what Sherwood Anderson was so great at, was, and that book, you know, Winesburg, Ohio, was so pivotal in sort of me coming up with these stories, the style, and also the structure of the book, was that, you know, he would take a story, he'd say, here is a human being, and here's a human being at a particular moment in their life where I call it the pressure cooker effect. It's like their lives are, things are building and building, and then this is the moment where the lid flies off the pot, and they are revealed to be, this is their essential humanity. And so mm-hmm. trying to find that moment in a character's life is, to me, the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as a reader, that's what compels us to read stories. Mm-hmm. And about vulnerability as well. And again, this is where this book turns it, because the vulnerability is not their outward, what their outward appearance is, even if that is being... even if they were in the freak show, you mm-hmm. know, that wouldn't be what the narrative is interested in. Their vulnerability has to do with something much more on a human level.
Right.
That's the same for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her book, The Circus in Winter. Will you read some more?
Sure. Well, we were just talking about, you know, sort of getting at sort of the story behind some of these performers. And this is one of the characters that people really seem to enjoy the most in my book is this character. Her name is Jenny Dixiana, and she's an acrobat. And I worked on this story for probably over the course of about 6 or 7 years. She's this femme fatale who runs around the winter quarters, you know, doing her spin of death and betting these men and just seeming to have a grand old time. And I finally said, you know, well, what makes somebody join a circus? And also, what makes a woman turn into a woman like this, someone who seems to have, she kind of had no moral center in a way. And I was very interested in her, so I decided that it had to have something to do with how she got her name, Jenny Dixiana, and sort of how she grew up. So this, I'll read a little bit of this. This is the backstory on Jenny. Jenny's father, Slater Marchette, was lucky to have survived the war with the Yankees, but he came home forever changed. He left a hard board of a man, but returned to his water oak shaded shack in the Alabama bayou as soft as oleander, a sap given to weeping and hand-holding. Slater hugged his wife and daughter so tight they lost their breath, and all that night the house shook with his fierce love. Slater spent 6 months walking home from the war, carrying nothing in his haversack but scroggling apples and an unblemished Confederate battle flag, which he hung on the wall of his home as if it were a priceless painting. After a time, he found work on a fishing boat in Bonsecours Bay, but came home each night to braid Jenny's hair and kiss his wife's growing belly. The night the baby came, his wife screamed and swore while he filled cookpots with her blood. "Quick," he said to Jenny, "run and get Sister. Tell her your mama's bleeding to death. Hurry." Sister wasn't family. She was a conjure woman who lived in a tin shanty just down the Shell Road. While he waited, he used every blanket, sheet, and towel to staunch the blood. When Jenny and Sister finally arrived, they found Slater awash in red, his wife blue-white and draped by the flag, the only piece of cloth left in the house. Sister clasped her leather-lined hands. "I don't understand. It didn't stop." She explained then that there was a verse in the Bible with the power to stop blood. "Only if you know which one it is, you say the person's name and read the passage." Sister looked at Jenny and then at Slater. "What's your wife's name?" Through tears, he said, "Annie, Anna Marchette." "That explains it then," Sister said, shaking her head. Your daughter said her name was Dixie Anna. That's what I told God." "A pet name," he cried. Jenny had never heard him use any other. Slater Marchette buried his wife, his darling Dixie Anna, under a shell mound with the baby still inside her. Jenny was 6. Half asleep, Jenny heard a voice say, "You are my sweet, my little Dixie Anna." It was her father, back from the boat, smelling of fish, sweat, and whiskey. In a minute, he'd start plaiting her hair while her mother fried mullet, and after dinner, when they thought she was asleep, the house would start its swaying. Jenny felt his hands, and then more. She kept her eyes screwed shut, held on to the image of her mother smiling. She was 12 now, not 6. One day, her father got so drunk he fell off his boat into the Gulf waters. After swimming to shore, he decided that a change in vocation was needed, a job conducive to benders. So he bought spades and shovels and went out each day in search of the pirate Jean Lafitte's hidden treasure. Legend had it that Lafitte had spent one winter hunkered down nearby in a secluded shanty, hiding from the Spanish Navy, and as a precaution, had buried a fortune in the sand. By now, Jenny was the man and woman of the house. Cook, farmer, laundress, barterer. Sometimes when she was hungry, she went down the road to Sister's. There was always food on the stove, and Sister paid Jenny to collect ingredients for her conjure balls and charm bags. People came from as far as Mobile and Pensacola to buy them. Jenny tried to save the money for winter, stashed in her mother's keepsake cigar box. But more often than not, her father would return from treasure hunting hungover and empty-handed, find the money, and buy himself another drunk. She began wearing her mother's old dresses, and at night her father buried his head in her calico lap for consolation. Sometimes, when blind drunk, he came home a buccaneer, one of Lafitte's black flag men, and he called her Veronica, his Creole mistress. "I gave you the map," he'd say, giving her a teeth-rattling shake. "Tell me where it is." He'd rip her dress open, drag her by the hair before he fell on top of her. He always cried during and after. Jenny never cried. Jenny was 16 when she finally told Sister all of it. Saying nothing, Sister lit a lantern and motioned for Jenny to follow her into the night. They made their way through fields of sea oats to the site of her father's latest dig, a long trench cut into the beach. In the moonlight, Jenny saw shovelfuls of sand shooting out of the hole to the familiar beat of her father's grunts. Sister picked up a shovel, swung it over her shoulder like a spike-driving hammer, and then handed it to Jenny. Sister whispered, "Your mama wouldn't have it no other way." Because he stood below her in the trench, and because it was dark, Jenny saw no blood, not even the look on his face. They tossed everything in the hole with him, whiskey bottles, shovels, tinned meat, his tent and blanket, even the blackened logs from his campfire, and the earth obliged, swallowing Slater Marchette whole. Later, Sister took a pair of scissors to his Confederate flag and fashioned a costume that blared plenty of midriff and thigh. She told Jenny a circus was showing up in Mobile. "A pretty little white girl like you, they'll snatch you up in a minute." When Jenny protested that she had no special talent, Sister opened the thin pages of her Bible and pointed to the verse that had nearly saved her mother's life. "You know this, you can do anything, child." She became Jenny Dixiana the moment that she signed her first performer's contract. Jenny Marchette was a dirty, flopsy doll buried deep in the sand.
With the characters, and I think we should probably talk a little bit about the structure of the book. So there are stories, but they are connected stories. They're a story cycle that builds a whole world of these circus people. So I'm wondering, are there stories that didn't make it into the collection, characters that didn't?
There was a story that didn't make it into the collection that was Jenny Perdido. She's a character in the last story. The first thing I read was her voice, and she is the great granddaughter of an elephant trainer. Her father is a local mortician, and her mother is a local girl who marries too young and ends up. I don't want to give too much away, but it's a big part of the story. And there, that family is sort of the center of the book, like the lineage that works itself down into Jenny. And there's a story in the book that Jenny has a story, her mom has a story called The King and His Court, and there was another one where Ethan Perdido, the mortician, had his own version of a story. But it just didn't work. It was actually set in New York City, and so it kind of didn't fit in very well.
We weren't in Peru in winter.
Right.
So, Lima.
So that was one story that didn't quite make it in. But really, most of the stories that I wrote for the book, I kind of – people ask me all the time, like, I think a lot of people wonder, you know, when you write a book like this, like, did you start off writing a novel or did you start off writing stories? And I literally did start off – thinking that I would write a Midwest, like, you know, my version of Winesburg, Ohio. I always wanted it to be interrelated stories. And so I always knew that, you know, as I was working on The King and His Court, I sort of also had the idea of what was going to happen in this other story. It was, I mean, writing any, you know, book length work is incredibly complicated, but I often think that what I actually ended up doing was writing 11 little novels.
I was going to say, you took the harder route.
Because... I sure did. I don't think I'm going to do this again, I don't think.
Because, you know, you had to keep thinking about how ultimately the stories all spin back in on themselves and create this kind of more comprehensive view of the world.
The book manuscript was actually accepted without the last story, Circus People, which actually ends up sort of tying the whole book together. The original version of the book manuscript had the last member of the Boella tribe as the last story. But my editor said, you know, I think that you really need a story that brings the reader into the present but also talks about the history of the town and sort of what's happening now. Like, what have these people in this town inherited by having this history? And so I set out to write sort of the story that was going to finish it all up. It started off at 60 pages, and then it ended up being, it took a long time. It was a very difficult story to write, to try to wrap everything up.
Sure, trying to put kind of the corral around the ponies after they've all been running around.
Yeah, it was really incredibly hard. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, too, in terms of, like, if you were changing details, let's say, in one story, would you have to go back and rework other stories?
Oh, yeah. One thing I realized, and there was a fact checker who went through and made sure that if somebody was singing a song, that the song had been written, you know, and I actually found out that there was the Tennessee Waltz.
Mm-hmm.
I had my characters dancing to it before it had actually been, you know, written. So I had to go back and change that detail in the whole story. And also, Wallace Porter is the owner of the circus, the guy who sort of builds this thing. And he's in a bunch of the stories. And the fact checker said, do you realize that he's about this age in the first story and he dies about then? So he's about 100 years old, which was really unlikely to happen back then. And I said, well, we just will. I hope people don't notice that.
I guess my last question is, did your opinion of circuses or circus people, I mean, the idea that, you know, you started out saying, here's this town I grew up in, it's mm-hmm. part of the culture, wanting to get away from it, and mm-hmm. then, immersing yourself in it yet again, is there something that you learned along the way?
I think that the most important thing I learned was that I thought that, the circus always represented escape, being able to live your life the way that you want it, the way you want it to be, maybe a little bit different than the way everybody else lives their lives. And I found in the end, and I always thought that I was a person like that, but in the course of having the process of going back to my town so many times and talking to people, I actually found that I love the town a lot more than I ever thought that I did, and that maybe I'm not as much of a wanderer as I always thought I was, that maybe I'm not so much circus people as I am really, in a way, a kind of town person. And that's part of moving to Pittsburgh and is an attempt to try to make it stick. I've moved around a lot in my life. So I thought that I was a circus person and then sort of ended up realizing that I was a town person.
Well, and if you think about it, the circus people end up on their off time creating a community as well.
Exactly.
They don't just kind of scatter to the winds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more kind of professional athletes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for coming to Prosody tonight, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wolk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile.